Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit, the best of part two that follows up last week, the best of part one. It was actually very successful because of the phone calls that we got as well as the emails after the show. And, of course, it was because Tammy Flanagan was here. Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, and, of course, you probably know her more so as the, what do you call that?
I don't know.
Author of the...
That's right. I'm not really a reporter, so I guess it's a columnist.
A columnist, that's it.
Yeah,
okay.
I have a column on Fridays.
Yeah, yes. And a lot of people follow that column. If you don't, you should. They're at govexec.com.
Or you can find it on nitpink.com, nitpinc.com on our website.
Okay. Very good. Anyway, Tammy, good to see you again.
Good morning.
And I'm Bob Lines. I'm an accountant, tax finance type, and does the seminars with Tammy. I always follow Tammy, of course, but we've got a full plate here, and we would love to hear from you. We're at 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. Remembering today is July 30th, 2012. It's 10:07. We have about another 50 minutes. Don't call us after that, but you can email us. I've thrown out too many emails and whatnot. But anyway, we've got a caller already. We haven't even said anything.
All right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What can we help you with this morning?
Yeah, my name is John. I have a question. I'm getting ready to retire later this year, actually, and there's a lot of confusion. I've gone on OPM's website. I read through about survivor benefits. I'm under the civil service retirement system. I've been working since like 1975. It's been a long time. I'm ready to go. But my wife has, got lots of questions about my survivor benefits. I really, can only read through so much to explain what my options are, and I haven't had a chance to set up an appointment with my retirement officer. So I just was wondering if you guys can explain to me exactly what my wife and I can do about my survivor benefit elections.
Whoa, that's the whole show. But Tammy, that's squarely in Tammy's court, a little bit in mine. Tammy?
Well, that's great. Thanks for calling in this morning, because that is one of the things we did want to talk about today, and that is that election that you make at retirement of what type of retirement do you want. So in your case, because you're married, you've got special considerations for your spouse. So, I think one of the questions a lot of people have, and maybe you do as well, is, how expensive is it and of what value does it have? So that's one of the things I want to take some time, and you might want to listen into the show so we can kind of pick that apart and figure out, is it really worth it? What does it really provide for your spouse? Besides financial security, are there any other benefits that go along with it? So I think this will be a great show for you, and hopefully your wife is there with you and she can listen in as well, because this affects you as much as it does her.
Yeah, she's actually at work. I don't think she's listening in, but I told her I'd get all the information. And it's my understanding I can listen to this show later. I can have her listen to it. I think you guys archive these shows, don't you?
We
about,
do.
About 2 p.m., Andrew puts it up. I didn't say good morning, Andrew. Good morning, Andrew. Andrew puts it up on the site about 2 o'clock-ish, okay. 3 o'clock-ish. Mm-hmm. But then it stays there. And you can email us questions afterwards.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, because she may have more questions than I have. When she's on tonight, we'll listen to the show again. But I'll listen right now, though. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
You can call, too, listeners. So please do. So it's one of the first things we had on our list, actually. So should we start with survivor benefits?
Let's do that. What are the choices?
Okay, well, first of all, what we're talking about here is an election people make when they retire. And not to say that if a federal employee were to die in service, there are also survivor benefits just built into your federal benefit package. But to start with, let's just talk about the election people make when they retire and some of the requirements that you have to consider when you're making these choices. So whether you're retiring under CSRS or under FERS, under the FERS system, on the retirement application, there's a whole section that says, it doesn't say what kind of retirement do you want, but it's called the survivor benefit election. And whether you're single, married, widowed, or divorced, you have to make one of five choices. And those five choices include electing a maximum survivor benefit for your current spouse, the person you're married to on the day of retirement, electing a partial survivor benefit for that spouse, electing no survivor benefit so that when you die, your retirement dies with you. The fourth choice is electing something called an insurable interest, which is something we'll have to talk about and explain what that means. Then the final, the fifth choice you have to choose from is electing a survivor benefit for your former spouses or your current and former spouse. And some people might be saying, why in the world would I want to elect a survivor benefit for my ex-spouse? Well, for two reasons. Number one, you might have to, because if it's in a divorce agreement or the court order at the time of the divorce, you're going to be required to go along with what it says and provide a copy of the divorce decree. So that's not really a choice. That's by law, you know, what the court had ordered you to do. But also, sometimes even if it's not in a divorce decree, or maybe you were divorced prior to the Spouse Equity Act back in 1985, but you were a federal employee at that time and married to that former spouse during part of your federal career. And for whatever reason, you might still want to provide a benefit, even though you're not required to do so by the court. And so that's an opportunity on the retirement application for you to make that election to provide some survivor benefit to your former spouse, but it does cause a reduction to your retirement. So I don't see it used very often, but apparently there are some people who do want to provide for their former spouses, whether it's because they're raising the kids or because they just still have a good relationship, even though they're not married anymore.
So how does it work? Well, the classic is a spouse or somebody with an insurable interest, but let's stay with spouse because I think that's easier to understand. If somebody was entitled to an annuity of, say, $50,000, and that's based on how do they figure the first annuity without any consideration for survivor's annuity, it's based on what, years in service and highest compensation?
Yeah, it's your what we call your unreduced annuity, whether it's civil service or FERS, it's a combination of looking at your total length of service, your years and months of service, any sick leave credit. And then you also have to calculate your salary, your high three average salary, which is usually the last 3 years of your career, which is typically the highest. Average that together, and that's your high three average. So you get a percentage of that high three average based on your length of service. Under the FERS system, you get 1% per year generally, sometimes 1.1% if you're over 62 with more than 20 years of service, but close to 1%. Under CSRS, it's almost 2% per year. The first 10 years, a little less generous, but give or take, you know, around 2% a year. So like you said, let's say that the unreduced retirement based on that calculation came to $50,000, just a nice round number. So if you're under the civil service system or the FERS system, you're going to take almost a 10% reduction under civil service, a full 10% reduction under FERS. Let's just say a $5,000 reduction off of the $50,000 retirement. So now your retirement during your lifetime has been reduced to $45,000. And that also reduces it for tax purposes. So that's pretty significant, I would think, if you're taking a 10% reduction, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's $5,000 less money to report to Uncle Sam. So you're living on the reduced annuity. Hopefully you and your spouse live a long, healthy lifetime. But eventually, most likely one or the other of you is going to die first. If your spouse predeceases you and you no longer have that spouse that you had when you retired, you can notify OPM and have your annuity restored. Put that $5,000 back into it so that you go back to the unreduced annuity. On the other hand, if you die first, this is what you've done. You've left your spouse 50% under FERS or 55% under CSRS of your retirement, and then your surviving spouse would receive that the rest of their lifetime. And what's nice about that is that it provides a benefit for life. It has annual adjustments for inflation, both before your death as well as they receive it. And it's something that you can't, it's a permanent election, so that you can't stop it. So therefore, it's going to be something they can count on to provide some financial security. The other thing that it does provide, in addition to that monetary, that financial support, it also provides your surviving spouse the ability to stay in the federal health benefit program should you die first. So if you die in a self and family enrollment and your surviving spouse is not a federal employee, they're not a federal retiree, they're counting on you to leave them enough to pay for their health insurance and to provide a way to continue it. So the survivor benefit provides both the health insurance continuation as well as the money. So it's a very valuable benefit from that standpoint, although it is expensive.
May I ask you another question?
Sure.
Let's go back to the $50,000 total example, unreduced for the survivor, and then the survivor is elected and it becomes 45, we say. Okay, now, is the survivor's annuity based on a percentage of the 45 or on the 50?
Neither. It's actually based on the 50, but keep in mind, like, I always use my Uncle Steve as an example. I've talked about Uncle Steve a lot because he was my hero, and he was the retired Fed who retired in 1978. So Uncle Steve was retired for 34 years. He passed away earlier this year. But during that 34 years, his unreduced annuity, or his reduced annuity, both, have increased due to cost of living adjustments almost, I think, actually a little more than three times over. So if his retirement was $11,000 a year in 1978, it was around $35,000, $36,000 a year this year. So what Aunt Helen is getting, who is his now his surviving spouse, is 55% of the $36,000. So it's just consider what your retirement, that $50,000 would be $150,000 if cost of living, if inflation did the same thing over the next 34 years. So the spouse gets 55% of the unreduced adjusted annuity. So it's receiving that COLA every year as well. And that's kind of hard to figure out, you know, what the future inflation rates are going to be. How long am I going to live? How long is my spouse going to outlive me? These are questions you don't know the answer to. You can guess, you can gamble, you can look at charts, but you really don't know. And so therefore, this is payable whether your spouse outlives you by 35 years or whether they outlive you by 6 months. It's providing that sense of security and that financial protection.
But it's more than I think what some people imagine it to be, because they take the 55% of the reduced annuity that the employee was getting.
Right.
And then it can be less than that. So then let's look at it on the financial side. Somebody might say, my spouse either can or can't live on their own with their own sources of revenues or somewhere in between, because the more you provide for a survivor, the less you get during your lifetime.
That's right.
I'm not remotely suggesting you have no survivor's annuity and buy life insurance. People do say that. Mm-hmm. That's a show unto itself. But somebody might say, well, I'll buy a lot of life insurance. The first myth to dispel there is people think that if they don't do that, then they'll have more money to buy life insurance. They don't, though, because they're going to have to pay tax on the difference. As Tammy mentioned, the difference between our example of 50 and 45 would not be subject to tax. Well, if it went up to 50, the $5,000 is subject to tax, so there isn't $5,000 to pay the premiums. And how much is enough?
Right. And how old are you, and how's your health?
Right.
It makes it difficult to buy life insurance if you're 62, diabetic, and had two heart attacks. You know, it may not work.
That's right. And I think our caller was on the job 37 years.
Since the early 70s.
75.
Didn't sound that old, but...
No. Well, wait a minute now.
But neither do we, right?
That's right. You much younger than I.
Oh, yes. Anyway. Much, much younger. So the other question you were talking about, we were kind of getting to, that was the full survivor benefit we said first. But the other choice you have to make, the other choice your spouse has to accept, is to elect a partial survivor benefit. Under both SERS and FERS, you can leave less than full survivor benefit. Now, under the FERS system, it's easy. It's either you leave your spouse half of your retirement or 25% of it or nothing. So it's three choices, half, 25%, or zero. Under civil service, you leave your spouse 55% of your full retirement or 55% of something less. And it has to be expressed that way. So you could say, how about if I leave you 55% of $25,000, you know, half of my retirement? And as long as your spouse gives their notarized consent to that election, you can do a partial survivor benefit. And the point of that is that it's going to be less expensive, as well as leaving them less money. So you'll have more money, as you said, for during your lifetime. So you have to come to some agreement as to how much is enough income to leave your spouse, whether or not it is that you passed away, hopefully not, but 2 days after you retire, all the way up to 34 years after you retire, and whether or not your spouse outlives you by 2 days or by 32 years. And that's the part that's hard to gauge. So I always say, you know, plan for the worst, you know, hope for the best. But, you know, that you always consider that, you know, something could happen and you don't want to leave your spouse shortchanged.
I'm sure you get these questions in class because I get them. And if I get them the day after you've been there, they probably ask both of us. So somebody elects a survivor's annuity but feels their survivor could pretty much stand on their own without consideration. But the health insurance is so important. And this is, I get this and say, can I do $1 a month and get the health insurance? And the answer is?
Well, under civil service, because you can elect a dollar amount, you can say, I'll leave you 55% of $22. So you're basically leaving your spouse a dollar a month. You could, with your spouse's consent, make that election to leave such a minimal benefit. The one thing I tell people, though, when they ask that, I'll say, yes, you can do it. Your spouse can agree to it. But wouldn't it be nice to leave them enough money to pay for the health insurance so that if they're 89 years old, they don't have to remember every month to write a check to pay for that health insurance? Because if they forgot to write the check, they stand to lose the insurance. So I always like to leave a spouse enough income that they can have this health insurance premium deducted from the survivor annuity. And keep in mind, they'll probably only need self-only coverage. And even as a surviving spouse, the government does still kick in their share of the premium. But nonetheless, you know, maybe leave them 55% of $5,000 at a minimum, or 55% of $10,000 if you want a little bit left over to cushion for future health insurance increases, which probably will happen. Now, okay. Under FERS, you don't have that much flexibility. Because, like I said, under FERS, you leave half, 25%, or none. But even the 25% is fairly inexpensive because it's only a 5% reduction to your retirement. And also under FERS, your retirement's not just FERS. You know, your retirement under FERS is you might have widow's benefits coming in from Social Security. You've got money in your TSP account that most likely there will be some left to pass on to your spouse. You really have to look at all three parts of FERS when you're considering survivor benefits for your spouse.
I think you answered the question.
No, I try.
And if not, for anybody listening, but certainly the gentleman that called, you can email us at 4FOR. Your, Y-O-U-R, benefit, B-E-N-E-F-I-T, at NITPINC.com.
Yep. And just keep in mind, if you are emailing us as the show is airing, we're not seeing those emails till afterwards. So we will get back to you, but we don't respond to emails during the show. So if you want to send something for next week, you can email us anytime during the week, and we usually respond to those the following week. But you can call us
at 202-465-3080. Okay. So, alternative, and we don't want to talk about alternatives.
Well, can we go back to survivor benefit one more thing? Because there's
sure.
A couple of other points I wanted to make before we leave that topic. I know we're kind of dwelling on it, but it's a big decision people make. And the one other option I mentioned was that insurable interest. I do want to spend just a second saying what that is and who can take advantage of it, because throws people. They don't know what it means. So when you're electing at retirement an insurable interest survivor benefit, you're saying, well, who would that be and how much does it cost? And, you know, who would do that? So normally an insurable interest election is made for someone who has some financial need for your life expectancy. You say, well, could that be my children? So yeah, it could be your children, but hopefully someday your children will grow up and become independent. So that's typically not who is elected, you know, as an insurable interest. It's more commonly someone you live with, but you're not married to. It could also be a same-sex partner that could be your insurable interest. And those are all acceptable options for that person to be in that category. So what will happen is if the person you're naming is the same age, within 5 years younger or older than you, then your retirement under both civil service and FERS would be reduced by 10%, almost like the spousal benefit. But the benefit paid to that person would be 55%, and under both CERS and FERS, it would be 55% of the reduced annuity. So it's not like the spouse where they're getting the unreduced, it's of the reduced amount. But nonetheless, it's still a lifetime benefit, it still gets cost of living adjustments, so it still can provide financial security for that person who you've named as your insurable interest. It does not, however, provide health insurance.
Okay. I'm going to throw you a question. It just came out. I understand insurable interest. But let's say I retire. I'm single. And 5 years, 10 years, I find somebody that would meet the definition of insurable interest. Can I then elect a survivor's annuity?
Not unless you marry them, because the insurable interest election can only be made at the time of retirement. However, if you get married after retirement, if you, as they say in the regulations, if you acquire a spouse after you retire, which I always laugh at that, but nonetheless, if you get married after retirement, OPM, you let them know, say, I just got married, and they'll say, well, would you like family health insurance? Because you can cover your spouse, your new spouse, with your federal health insurance. And also, would you like to provide your new spouse a survivor benefit? and they will give you, I call it a 2-year test drive, so that you'll have 2 years from the date of marriage to determine whether or not you think that new spouse is worthy of that survivor benefit, because it's going to cost you money. It's going to take, you know, that reduction to your retirement, and it's your choice at that point rather than having the spouse's, you know, legal right to it. So you can make that election after you retire, but it will cost you some money.
Okay. I thought you could. I just didn't know the rules.
Yep. Okay. Now we can move on.
All righty. What do we got next? What can employees do to make their retirement processing go smoother?
Well,
and I know you're a big proponent of talking about this.
Well, only because we're in this time where there's, you know, massive delays in processing. You know, OPM is working really hard to get that down, backlog of applications under control. And they have made strides in that since January. The backlogged applications have gone from 61,000 sitting there waiting to be processed. We're down to about, I think the last I saw the report was 48,000. So they've made headway, but there is still a backlog. There is still a waiting period when you first retire. So you wouldn't want something you've done to further cause a delay. So there are things that employees can do prior to retirement and during the retirement process to make sure there's no further delays in what's already a very time-consuming process. So prior to your retirement, I'd say even 5 years before you retire, that's when I would suggest requesting your first retirement estimate from your agency's HR office. Now, it could very well be, depending on the agency that you work for, that you make that request and the agency comes back and says, we are so overwhelmed ourselves in HR that we can't respond to your request 5 years before you can retire. So if they won't do it, they won't do it. Some agencies say within a year. But if you can get a first baseline estimate within 5 years of your first retirement eligibility, that's going to weed out any problems with your personnel records. That's going to let you know if you owe any money to the retirement fund, if there's any discrepancies in your records, if there's any missing records or misfiled records. You know, we've only had electronic record keeping for a few years. So in the days when we used to keep records in cardboard folders on thin skin pages, they would get misfiled, misplaced. I've seen records shredded, flooded, burned, destroyed, you name it. So you want to make sure that all of your records still exist. They're still what's needed to document your service. So getting that first estimate, whether it's a year before you retire, better yet, 5 years before you retire, can give you a heads up and make sure that everything's where it needs to be so that the retirement processing can take place. Now, when it gets closer to retirement, I'd say when you're within 60 to 90 days of retirement, that's when you're going to fill out the application. Now, keep in mind, because OPM does not electronically process retirements, they do most of the processing manually, that application is going to be read by a human being. So make sure, I would suggest filling it out online. They're fillable forms. You can type in the information, so they're very legible. You can read them. And also, make sure OPM knows how to find you. So if you're going to be moving after you retire, if you're going to be traveling around the country, make sure you include a cell phone number, maybe even include a secondary address where mail can be sent, because there are certain documents that OPM might send you that they will not forward. And so you want to make sure that you're not going to delay any responses you might be making because they can't reach you. So make sure you include that information about, you know, I'm living here until this date, then I'll be moving to that address, or I'll be on travel. So please send any information to my son or my brother, you know, whoever. So, you know, make sure you're reachable after you retire as well. And also double check that application, because you'd be surprised how many people forget to make a survivor benefit election. They see that section, they say, oh, I'm not married, I'll just leave it blank. But everybody, regardless of who you are, has to fill in one of those five choices. And there's an initial that's required. There's also signatures that's required. And I know that some people have a hard time putting that signature on the application because that makes it final. You know, I've signed it, now I'm actually going to leave. But don't forget, before you turn it in, to make sure you sign it, check it over, make sure you've answered all the questions, provided a response, and make sure it's very legible, because that little bit can slow the whole process down.
I like your comment about starting 5 years early, because there could be some things that somebody wouldn't be aware of, like maybe they have a redeposit to make and they kind of forgot about it. And the longer it goes on, the interest rate accumulates to be significant.
That's right. And if you want to make a choice of whether or not you want to pay it, you might need some time to accumulate the money to pay it off if that's the decision that you make. Because OPM will give you one last chance to pay back a civilian service deposit for like temporary service or any other non-covered service, or for a refunded period of service, like you mentioned, a redeposit. You can pay those back even during the time your retirement's being processed, but then you have to write the check and get it in there so that the whole thing can be finalized, because that's your last chance to pay back a civilian deposit. If you owe for military service, you want to get that taken care of before you retire, because that's a payment you make to your own payroll office rather than paying it directly to OPM.
Okay, and as an aside here, the tax part of me has to say this. If one is going to make a military buyback time or a redeposit, whatever the check is that they write would certainly be for the principal amount, but it would also include an interest component. But that becomes not tax deductible all at once, but it goes into the tax-free portion of the annuity outside of what was taken from their salary throughout their career. And I think people don't, when I talk about it in class, I talk about it more if I'm in a military type organization than I would a social, but I do bring it up.
Right.
And they go, really? And I go, yeah, just make sure that that's accounted for. OPM does a fine job. But it's
yeah, what
a,
Bob's
it's
talking about is every 2 weeks out of your paycheck, there's a deduction for FERS. If you're under the FERS system, there's also withholding for CSRS. The one for civil service is 7%, so it's more substantial. But even the FERS contribution is about 1% of your salary. So as that money accumulates in the retirement account, after you retire, you get that money back, and it's money that you've already paid taxes on. So along with any deposits, redeposits you've made, and those contributions, you get that back as a tax-free portion of your civil service or FERS retirement. Is that about half of your retirement's tax-free?
No. No.
How much can I count on being tax-free?
Maybe 10% of
maybe
it.
10%.
Maybe
10%.
FERS, probably a smaller percent.
Is it every year?
Every year for what Congress has considered their life expectancy. While an individual might know that they're a descendant of Methuselah or they have bad chemistry in the family as far as longevity, there's a chart. And it's a little elongated. But
where would I find that chart?
It's in IRS Publication 721. IRS Publication 721. Now, I'm not a tax geek. I do tax work, but Tammy's laughing. IRS Publication 721, as well as most other IRS publications, are devoted to a particular area, home mortgage interest, selling your house. But in this case, it's for the federal retiree. Now, I've been doing this an awful long time, and the publication number has stayed the same every year, but the information inside of it changes every so often. And this one thing changed in 1996, and it...
86. Wasn't it 86?
Well, 86, they got rid of the old three-year rule, but in 90, and then there was different ways to do it. In 96, it said, here's the chart.
Oh, okay. They made it easier?
Yeah, it's very simple. Yeah. It says, how old are you at the day you retire? So you look down and you find your age in a column, and then it says go to the right. And its next column says number of payments. Now, why it can't say number of months, I don't know. But number of payments means number of months. So there's your life expectancy. Mm-hmm. And if you have a survivor's annuity, you can't use that chart. They're right next to each other. Mm-hmm. So a survivor's annuity would take into consideration the retiree's age at retirement and their survivors added together. So you just add the two numbers, do the same thing, go to the column, find your ages. It's within
groups.
And
how do you get the amount that you've paid into the retirement fund?
Well, that's going to come to you once you do retire, but it can't come to you until after you retire because this withholding is done through the last day you're on the job.
So OPM will give you that lump sum.
They'll give it to you not only in the first year of retirement, but every year thereafter. It comes on what's called an IRS Form 1099-R.
About the same time as I would normally get a W-2?
They come in January. Yep. The difference between a W-2 and a 1099-R is you can read the 1099-R and understand it. Wide open spaces, and there's just one box, bottom left-hand side of the page, and a lot of white space here now, so you can't kind of miss this. And so here's what you put into the system. Now, there are some folks that don't have this. For example, the Foreign Service people, their 1099-R does not have this. So they have to make the calculation manually, although their retirement office, if you will, is in Charleston, South Carolina, and they send just one letter the year after they retire and said, this is how much you've put into the system.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody needs to keep that. And of course they would do it accurately. But that tax-free portion, as Tammy kind of brought up, let's say somebody had a 25-year life expectancy. It lasts 25 years. Mm-hmm. At the time the individual lives longer than the 25 years, then the annuity becomes fully taxable. Now, in class, people go, this is terrible. And I said, it's much better than the alternative. So we want to outlive the life expectancy. We want to pay tax on the full amount of the annuity. And I had one person in class, it was a couple years ago, really took me to task on it and said, I do not want to pay tax on the full amount of my annuity, even if it means that I would have to die. And I go, okay, next question. And she was very, you know, she wasn't mad at me. She was just mad at the idea that it would become fully taxable. But anyway, that's
certain
how it
ways
works.
You don't want to beat the system. But
no, you do not.
That would be among them.
Yeah. So that's kind of a, there's another thing we can do, but we're not. You know, the cash left, if any. Transfer of the insurances into retirement. Now, I'd imagine the basic health care coverage, and we still can change in open season?
Yes. All the insurances, because now we have quite a few. You know, we've got all the alphabet soup with FEHB and FEGLI and FEDVIP and, you know, FELTSIP and everything else. But the two original, I would call them original, you know, the FEHB has been around since 1960. That's your health insurance. And as long as you meet the two conditions to continue that into retirement, which is having it for the last 5 years of your career and retiring on an immediate annuity, meaning you're eligible to retire when you leave. So as long as you meet those two conditions, your agency will verify for OPM that you've met those conditions. They will transfer the coverage for you. So you'll get a statement. It'll be a form that says your health insurance, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, whatever you have, has been transferred to the Office of Personnel Management. And once your retirement is finalized, all the premiums will be deducted from that check before they send it to you, and you'll just go on as normal. So you'll have no gap in your coverage. You'll be covered, you know, from the time you're left employment until the day you start retirement. Same thing with FEGLI, you know, the government life insurance. Same provisions. You have to have had it for 5 years, and you have to retire on an immediate annuity. You will make an election of how you want that to continue, the life insurance, because some employees, by the time they're near retirement, their needs for life insurance are different than what they were 20 or 30 years ago. You know, the kids might be grown, the house might be paid off. So you might want to reduce some of the FEGLI. You might want to let it reduce after you retire. So you'll make some elections on that life insurance coverage, whether it's just the basic coverage or whether you've elected the optional FEGLI coverage. So you'll have a say-so in how much of that you want to continue based on how much you're willing to pay. But your agency, again, will transfer that coverage to OPM for you. So you don't have to do anything besides fill out the form. Now, for FELTSIP, which is the long-term care insurance, you should, I would suggest, contact long-term care partners. You can go to ltcfeds.com. You can, you know, link to it from your agency's personal page and let them know that you're going to retire, let's say, December 31st, so that they can then either have that premium deducted from your checking account or they can direct bill you for it so that you'll have continuous payments of those premiums. Eventually, OPM will withhold the premiums from your retirement check, but your agency doesn't transfer that coverage as smoothly as it does for the FEHB and FEGLI. And that's the same thing with FEDVIP. If you have the federal employees' dental or vision supplemental insurance, that's not part of FEHB, so that's not going to continue just as smoothly as your health insurance did. So they recommend that you contact BeneFeds, which is BeneFeds.com, BeneFeds.com, and let them know that you're retiring on whatever date. And then, again, they can make plans to bill you directly for those premiums so that you'll have continued coverage under the health or the supplemental dental and vision plan. Now, the only one of the alphabet soups that does not follow you into retirement is FSA Feds. So the flexible spending account program that you've enjoyed during your career, giving you a nice tax break, that's strictly an employee benefit. So you will not get to have a flexible spending account after retirement for either health care or dependent care.
So load up on it while you're in service.
Yeah, and by the way, there's going to be a change next year.
Yeah, it's going to go down. Yeah.
Yeah, only on the health care side, the FSA Feds for the health care account is reduced from $5,000 maximum to, do you know what it is for next year?
$3,150, I believe.
$2,500. Yeah, the health care reform. This is just as a result of that original health care legislation. It's just destined to take effect 2013, and that does affect the FEHB, our program, as well as private sector plans.
All right, you've got a bullet point here. Be sure to have a nest egg for the processing period, or what to do if you don't.
Right. Yes. As we said at the front of the show, that, and I think most employees now have heard this or have been told this, that when you retire, and because of the backlog going on at OPM, that there's going to be a period of time. It could be anywhere from 3 months to a year, averages around 5 to 8 months, where you're going to be in a partial retired status, meaning you're not going to be getting your full retirement checks. You're going to be getting a prorated portion of them. And so you might be getting half, 80%, 90%. We don't know for sure because we don't know what's in your case when it arrives at OPM to determine how much of the full benefit you're going to get initially. So while you're in that partial status, they call it interim retired pay, or some people refer to it as special pay, you're not going to have as much money as you used to. So you still have to pay the same bills. You still have to buy the same groceries. So you want to make sure you have some money set aside during that period of time as you're transitioning from being an employee to becoming an annuitant. Now, a lot of employees, what they do to manage that is in the year before they retire, they'll save up their annual leave. So you don't take any annual leave. Like if you were going to retire the end of December of 2012, you might be spending this entire year not taking a vacation. So every 2 weeks, you're saving up the 8 hours of leave that accumulates. And plus, you might have carried over 240 hours from last year. So as long as you retire before the end of the leave year, which this year the leave year ends, I think it's January 12th of 2013, as long as you're off the payroll by then, payroll will write you a check for your unused annual leave. So if you're cashing out as much as 448 hours of leave, that's going to be a nice lump sum of cash that comes to you generally within 6 weeks of your separation. And a lot of employees have used that money to help tide them over while they transition into full retirement status. Now, eventually, OPM will pay you what they owe you, but it might, like I said, it might not be for 8 months. So you want to have some money to hold you up while you're waiting for that to happen.
And watch out for your taxes on that, too, because that amount, like Tammy mentioned, is a lot of hours, which translates to a lot of dollars. That together with the annuity and maybe the last paycheck. It could get clipped with some taxes. Mm-hmm. And it just...
And payroll will do a withholding, but it may not be what you owe.
Right. And once in the interim status, before the full adjudication of the annuity is done, as I understand it, you cannot have state taxes withheld from it.
You can have state tax withheld from the lump sum leave check, but not from your interim retirement checks.
And if that lasts 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, you just can't do it. Then you have to file something called estimated taxes, which is another topic on another show. But just be aware of that. Or you could have excess withholding prior to or once the annuity kicks in.
Right. But things you need to know if you're moving as well, because some states exempt your retirement from state income tax. Some don't have a state income tax. So that, like you said, that should be... We got an idea for another show.
Okay. We that's in actually every book that we do. And we need to break the record here. We've only got one phone call. I think we had three last week. So you have 12 minutes. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Again, July 30th, 1045. We're on for about another 12, 13 minutes, right, Andrew? And then after that, you can email us. But we already did that, so let's get back to the topics. But please give us a call. And you can ask us anything. It doesn't have to just be on retirement. It could be financial planning. It could be...
Don't ask me about baseball, though. I'm just learning that. I went to my first Nats game this year.
Well, I think...
I'm becoming a baseball fan.
People are getting the fever.
But going back to that, tiding you over during that transition, you know, what if you don't have the lump sum of annual leave? What if you didn't know to save it up, or you're retiring at the beginning of the year and you don't have as much to cash in? Then what some people will do, and again, this can get into all kind of tax things, but some people will take a partial withdrawal from their thrift. So you can do that after you separate. But again, that money's never been taxed. So be aware of the tax consequences.
Okay, we got a phone call.
All right.
Number two, good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's me again, actually. I was the one that called at the beginning.
Our lone listener. Thank you.
I don't get compliments of looking young, but your compliment earlier, but I don't sound too old. But very nice of you. Hey, you know, you talked about cost of living adjustments increasing the survivor benefit for my wife, but does that mean that I'm going to have to pay more? Is it going to cost me more as my pension increases? Is it going to cost me more as I continue to live because my survivor benefit is increasing.
You're a fast learner, boy, and you think very well, too. So, yes, as time goes on, as your retirement goes up with the cost of living adjustments, like last year, civil service retirees received a 3.6 COLA. FERS retirees got a 2.6 COLA. So as the value of that unreduced annuity is increasing, which is the basis for the survivor benefit, then that difference between the full annuity and the 10% reduction is becoming a bigger number as well. So you're right. The cost of that is increasing over the time of your lifetime, as just as much as the value of the benefit you're leaving is increasing. So that is something to consider. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I guess in a way, though, I guess for me and my wife, and I'll talk to her about it tonight, is that it really is not, at least maybe I'm not thinking about this right, but maybe it's not that big of a deal because my benefit is increasing, so obviously so is the corresponding cost. And, of course, the positive thing is so is my survivor benefit for my spouse, so it makes sense that I would be paying more for a bigger benefit for her to get to keep up with the rising cost of, I guess, inflation and everything.
Yeah, it's one of those half-empty, half-full kind of things you look at because you say, well, the bad news is it is getting more expensive, but the good news is the value of it is keeping pace with inflation. So I'm not leaving her 55% of $50,000 30 years from now. 30 years from now, that might be 55% of $150,000, which is what she'll need if that's what inflation has done over the next 30 years. So, yeah, I know it's a tough reduction because it's expensive. You know, 10% of your retirement's a very big bite to take out of it. But on your spouse's point of view, especially, and I don't know if she has her own retirement, you say she's working, so she might have be accumulating her own benefits. But depending on how much she's depending on your income, that can be the difference between being able to stay in the house or moving in with your kids.
Yeah, and I married a young one, so she's probably going to outlive me by many, many years, so it's important to me to provide her with something for the rest of her life.
All right, and as well, I don't know if your agency provides retirement seminars. We're in about 60 different agencies around D.C. and outside of D.C. as well, so if you can participate in that, some allow spouses, some don't. It could be as short as a 1 day, it could be as long as a 3 day, and it really slices and dices benefits, dollars, tax, legal, health, and psychology.
Yeah, we've got speakers all over the country. North Carolina, we've got a speaker. We've got one in Florida, Denver, so we can reach you just about anywhere you are.
Gotcha. Yeah, we had somebody come out. I don't know who it was, if it was you guys or not, but we had somebody come out last year. And I missed it. I had some other things I had to do, but hopefully I'll check with my training office to see if there's going to be another class offered between now and the end of the year.
Okay.
Great. You won't regret it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. All righty, Tammy. The I won't say the best because they're all the best articles that you write each week, but it seems that the Best Day of the Year to Retire article really gets a lot of...
It gets a lot of attention. Yeah. And I'm not exactly sure what it is, if it's urban myth or, you know, Mike Causey started this back in the 90s with this best date to retire, the magic date. You know, so everybody thinks there's something magic about it. But it's really understanding how the rules work and understanding when your retirement commences and what you stand to lose if you don't pick a good date. So what I always tell employees is make sure before you even think about setting a date for retirement, make sure you're mentally prepared to make this transition in your life. Make sure you're financially ready to retire. And then, like I said before, when you're 60 to 90 days away from when you think you're going to retire, that's when you're going to set the exact date. So you probably have a general idea that, you know, I want to retire towards the end of the year. I want to retire around my birthday or whatever it happens to be. But when you focus on that particular time frame, then you pull out your calendar and pull out a calendar that has the leave periods marked off on it. So that if you can, try to retire not only towards the end of a month, but also perhaps towards the end of a leave period. Because if you retire in the middle of a leave period, like 1 week into it, you're not going to accumulate the leave that you've accrued for that week. So if you can finish out the 2 weeks, you'll accumulate your last accrual of leave. Now, unfortunately, not every month ends nicely at the end of a leave period. So sometimes, like the end of the year, for instance, last year, the leave year did end on December 31st. But like I said, this year, the leave year ends January 12th. So then you want to either look at the end of December. If you're CSRS, you have a little grace period every month. You can go out the first, second, or third of the month, and your retirement will still begin the next day. So sometimes you'll see CSRS employees retiring on January 3rd because you can get paid for the holiday, you get a couple more days of salary, a couple more days of service added to your record. So that might be, you know, preferable over December 31st. This year and even next year, you might see FERS employee retiring mid-month. they might retire that last day of the leave year knowing that they're going to forfeit the January retirement check, but they're going to gain, you know, 10 days of salary for January. They're going to gain another leave accrual. Next year, they'll gain the full credit for their sick leave in 2014, which they're not going to get this year. So there are reasons why sometimes a FERS employee might choose to retire mid-month, especially if their 1 month of retired pay is about equivalent or even less than 1 2-week paycheck. So it's a numbers game, and it's also a rules game. So you have to know the rules, and you have to know the numbers.
And you also have to know, to read Tammy's article on that, it's, I think, more slanted towards FERS people than CSRS, the mid-month. Am I?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And you wrote an article, I forget when, it was maybe a year and a half or so ago.
No, I write it every year.
No, the FERS people, the mid-month thing. You write the best day to retire.
That was December of 2010, actually.
Okay. I never thought of it before.
But it's still in the archives.
Yeah, okay. So, and it's archived on nitp.inc.com.
Actually, I think I redid that this year, but I don't remember what the date was. But yeah, they're all there.
But the other one you usually do in the earlier part of the year, and it's the best day to retire in the coming calendar mm-hmm. year. But I like what you do as well. You talk about sometimes the best dates in the year not to retire.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at FERS and classically you look at the end of the month, but not always, you'll say, watch out for these months. And you do the reverse for the CSRSers. Mm-hmm. For 3 days, maybe you don't want to do it in these months, and you explain why.
Right.
So that article is prints out very nicely.
And it gives you the calendar.
Yes, it does.
With the leave periods marked off.
And if you can do it in color, because the article is in color, it's even nicer.
Now, I know sometimes when I follow you in a seminar, sometimes employees say, well, Bob said mid-month or mid-year might be a good time to retire for tax reasons. Are there some specific tax reasons you could point out to maybe somebody going out around the July 4th holiday rather than the December holidays?
It's more like this. People, if they've got another 6 months, could it impact the high three? Maybe, but I don't know that it would always be the case.
Yeah, okay. Especially these days with pay freeze.
But people sometimes bristle at that because they'd have 6 more months of the higher salary relative to what their annuity is going to be. They've got the accumulated leave paid and 6 months of the annuity benefits and maybe something else. So you've got 3 stacks of income that could push somebody up into a higher bracket. And then somebody'd say, well, why would you even consider this? And the terminology is called front load the thrift. For those of you that don't recognize that term, most people who could or who would want to maximize it at whatever level they can, they spread it out over 26 pay periods because they can afford it.
And they get the matching if they're FERS.
Right. But if they're only going to be there through the end of June or the early part of July, they're not going to have 26 pay periods. Let's just say it's 13 pay periods. But they're unaware that they could take the max if they could afford to do this mm-hmm. and then put that full amount in there. They wouldn't lose a penny, but they would drop down their taxes out of maybe a higher bracket to a lower bracket. They'd save taxes and put more money into a tax shelter. The realistic viewpoint of this would be if one would do that, they might have trouble paying their bills. However, because the thrift contribution is not going to be subject to income tax, they can adjust their income tax to be a lower number that would provide more cash flow to do this. Hmm. Now, this might be a lot to say in the last 4 minutes of the show, but it makes the June, instead of people bristling that it could go into a higher bracket, they could stay out of the higher bracket and do themselves a favor at the same time.
So if next year, let's say that the TSP limit stays at $17,000, and then if you're over 50, you can do another $5,500 catch-up. So if I can do the whole $22,500, if I divided that by 13 pay periods, and if I could afford to have that much withheld from my paycheck every 2 weeks, then by the end of June, when I plan to retire, I could actually have contributed the whole $22,500. And if it's in the traditional thrift, lowered my taxable income for next year by that same amount. So that's
perfect.
Big tax savings, I guess.
Yeah, and again, you're taking it off potentially even higher taxes than what you're used to. So, I mean, it just benefits all the way around.
Now, what if my idea of retirement is to retire June 30th and start my new job the day after day after 4th of July? So I'm going to have a second career for the second half.
Even a better example, because now we've got 4 sources of income.
But can I contribute to my next employer's 401k plan if I've already put $22,000 in the thrift?
No.
No. Okay. So if I'm going to get matching on that plan, I better take that into consideration, right?
Right.
Okay. Good. Lots of good information I think we've shared with each other as well as with the audience. So we always learn, don't we, when we do these shows?
I when I go to class, I learn probably something from every class. Maybe it's not a technical tax. It's I learn how somebody's thinking to carry to the next class. Well, here's an example that some of you may have not thought of, but not way out there stuff.
Yeah, so that proves the point to how to learn, you have to teach.
Yeah, I really enjoy it, and you know, occasionally you'll get an email or two, and I think we all do. And you feel good walking out. You always have questions after class. You stay around. You don't take breaks, as you well know. You usually do the whole day, so I hope you get a lunch break.
Yeah, I do take a lunch. Sometimes I hide at lunch just to get a little quiet time, but that's okay.
All righty, and. We don't have much time left here, but we have a little bullet point here. TSP, would I, could I, should I? What we're trying to say there is when you do leave, what do I do with the TSP? Do I have to touch it? The answer is no, depending on your age. But you do have to touch it by the time you hit 70 and a half. Now, in between then, you can kind of do as you please, but you can't just access it as you please and say, gee, I need some money for a car. I need this. You can't randomly
access
it.
Unless you move it. You can move it to an IRA and then take it out.
You can move a piece of it to the IRA and use it for your kind of flexible distributions. Mm-hmm. Or you could do the monthly payment, set it at the least amount of $25 a month. And when you do need it, you could jack it up for a year, pay off that bill, then bring it back down.
Right. As long as you plan in advance, because you can only change that once a year. But yeah, that's a good way to monitor the withdrawals.
We could probably spend half a show on that one.
I think we'd spend a whole show on that one.
It's not as tightly controlled as you might think. It's not as loose as a traditional IRA, but many people are comfortable. And I think we have 1 minute left. Andrew is saying, shut up, Bob.
We're almost done.
Let's take another call, but I don't think another call is coming in. So final comments, Tammy?
Just to keep on top of things, if you're planning to retire, don't leave it all up to your HR office. Take some responsibility, do the homework, and you should have a nice, smooth transition.
And, of course, watch your finances. Don't be broadsided with what you hear at the proverbial water cooler or the coffee pot. Know it. And if you don't know it, email us, NITPINC.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.